Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to welcome you to this panel discussion, which is sponsored by CUPS, the Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans. There's several of us here, part of the panel, who are part of CUPS. We're delighted you're all here this morning. If you want more information about CUPS and our activities, or if you'd like to become members, or if you're just one of the lovely items we have for display, we do have a booth in the exhibition hall. Today's discussion is paganism and humanism, can this marriage be saved? This is a very interesting situation. The UUA just like is a reflection of the larger culture. In the spiritual systems that I originally learned, we call this macrocosm and microcosm. The microcosm of the UUA reflects the macrocosm of the culture in which we live. And I'm sure all of you know in the cultures with which we live, you're going to find a lot of blended families. People who have come together through love, affection, chance, or blood, and find themselves sitting down at the table with a lot of different people. Maybe not the ones they originally expected to be there. I have a very fond memory from my own history where I am a practicing pagan, my older sister is Swami Hastananda of the Temple of Kriya Yoga, and my parents are Roman Catholics. One Thanksgiving, we all sat down together, and my mother said, well, it's time to say grace, and there was this kind of awkward pause, and my father said, why doesn't everybody say a blessing? My sister did a yogic blessing, I did a pagan-style blessing, my father gave a traditional Catholic prayer. We were all happy and had a wonderful dinner together. And that, to me, has always been paradigmatic of what I would love to see in the UUA. So today we're going to explore the blended family with what some people think are the two most disparate elements, paganism and humanism. And let me introduce our panel. On the far end of the table there is Joan Van Beesler. Joan is the current president of the Covenant of UU Pagans. Hard-working woman, the coordinator of academic administration at the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, and a doctoral student in the area of religion and social change at Iliff. She is also a candidate for community ministry and is doing an internship at First Universalist Church of Denver. She has an MDiv from Iliff and a Master of Public Administration degree from the University of Colorado at Denver. Joan. Next to her, as we move down the table, is the Reverend Dr. Kendall Gibbons. She's a lifelong UU, a 1980 graduate of Meadville-Lombard Theological School. And after 15 years at the DuPage UU Church in Naperville, Illinois, she is now serving as a senior minister of the First Unitarian Society of Minneapolis. She is also an adjunct faculty member at Meadville-Lombard, where she teaches worship and liturgical arts. I'm going to skip to the very end of the table here, and the Reverend Stefan Johansson, did I say that correctly? Jonathan, Reverend Stefan Johansson. I checked the first name and not the second. That'll teach me. He is the secretary of Friends of Religious Humanism, currently UUA District Executive for Western Canada, which he has been since 1991, and the UUA Coordinator of Services to Large Congregations beginning next month. And lastly, we have Patrick Price, the Reverend Patrick Price. He is a graduate of 1995 from Meadville-Lombard Theological School and has been a settled minister of the Theologically Diverse UU Fellowship of Columbia, South Carolina, where he is involved in community inter-multi-faith efforts. He is currently serving as treasurer for the Continental CUPS organization. The Reverend Price is involved with contemporary paganism since 1986 and helped start several organizations, including the Pagan Community Council of Ohio and the Dayton, Ohio CUPS chapter. And I realized I have failed to introduce myself. I am Phaedra Orbeck. I am a UU now down in North Carolina, and I am also on the Continental Board of CUPS. So for our discussion, we're going to have each of our panelists make an initial statement, and then we'll be able to take questions. And we're going to start with Reverend Price.
What the panel agreed to do, because you're having trouble seeing, is that for our initial presentations, we'll come to the microphone here at the podium, and then during the panel, we will be sitting down. Okay? The minister in my first congregation, which I joined back in 1989, related once a story to me about his coming to that fellowship in Ohio and his experience as an extension minister in his interview there. A board member asked him, how can you, as a young neo-transcendentalist, how could you possibly minister to me as an old humanist? And he took a moment to think about it, and he related that his reply was that I can minister to you and you can minister to me because we're both human beings, with all that that implies. Covenant and marriage. We chose this topic and this title because we as Unitarian Universalists are part of a covenantal tradition, and marriage is the most basic and fundamental of human and covenantal relationships. In covenant, in a marriage, we enter into a relationship which is based in process and the ways in which we are to be in relationship, rather than focused on an end, as one would find perhaps in a contract. In this, the covenantal approach to conflict, one is in conversation, in which we seek understanding and reconciliation, rather than argument, in which one starts from a predetermined end and endeavors to win or to subdue the other into agreement. It is the difference between contest and cooperation, between independence and interdependence. When contemporary pagans speak of the sacred marriage of the goddess and the god, it is this type of relationship which we understand to be present in the very fabric of the universe. It is therefore a religious act and an act of faith which we engage in when we engage in talking about marriage and in conversation. For those who desire a rigorous process, one which stirs the blood, then all one has to do is to experience the strength and discipline which it requires to stay at the table with someone you fundamentally disagree with. Our intention here is not to forge agreement or consensus about each other's faith traditions or positions, but perhaps to find points of understanding with each other as Unitarian Universalists, which will be relevant to how we can be together within our larger covenant. Thank you.
And I'd like to invite to the podium now Reverend John. I'm going to butcher your name. Jonathan. Thank you. He's forgiving, too.
It's a pleasure to be here at this CUPS-sponsored workshop today. I am mindful, though, of a story about Gilbert, of Gilbert and Sullivan fame, when he arrived at a hotel where a minister's convention was taking place and said that he felt as though he were a lion in a den of Daniels.
Yeah.
My fear today is perhaps that some of my humanist friends and colleagues might say that when it's all over, I was only a pussycat. Can this marriage be saved, was the question asked by the workshop title. And it's an interesting question, one that I loved at first and then started to question. I questioned whether it really is a marriage or a cohabitation. And these are very different things, at least in the early years of a relationship. I will concede, though, that there is probably more of a kinship than either humanists or pagans are willing to concede. We are, in a sense, like the inscription on the statue in Blaine, Washington, between the Canada and U.S. boundary, children of a common mother. Not so much in a marriage covenant of faith, but siblings of a sort. Perhaps we're only cousins, increasingly distant cousins, given our intensity at times. And given that intensity, perhaps our question should be first, can we live in our parents' house together? And secondly, if we can't, who claims the inheritance? It strikes me that much of the passion in our conversation, sometimes argument between humanists and pagans, has much to do with this quality of relationship and with the question of the inheritance of this Unitarian Universalist tradition. And it is especially complex for Unitarian Universalists because for most of us, this is an adopted faith. We are not even birthright children of that common mother. For the past 10 years, I've served a small Unitarian Universalist congregation in a small town on the Canadian prairies. Arburg, Manitoba has 1,000 people, and a small band of faithful Unitarian Universalists of Icelandic descent who have been in that community for the better part of a century. The church is full of multi-generational Unitarian Universalists, people with 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 generations of connection to the Unitarian Universalist tradition. There are Christians and humanists, a smattering of spiritualists of the old style variety, and a New Age person or two. And I never thought much about how hard it is to hold that group of people together until my ELF sermon a couple of years ago. You see, many Icelandic people believe in the huldufólk, the hidden people. And I thought that it would be rather uncontroversial for me to, well, make fun of that notion in the context of a sermon. I confessed to the group that I was a huldufólk agnostic. My UUA trustee said I was a shameless coward, but what I really was a huldufólk atheist, a non-believer without the courage to admit it to that congregation. But what became apparent after the sermon was that the village atheist and I were on opposite sides of the question of whether the hidden people exist. We found ourselves quarreling over the question of truth. Me and this person who I thought would be a natural ally, I assumed that as the village atheist, a difficult job in a town of 1,000 people, that she and I would be in complete harmony. And I was astonished that she believed in the little people, and she was astonished that I couldn't see that their presence was obvious. And it raised for me a question between values and content. For the village atheist and I share common values. We share common values socially, politically, even spiritually. We believe in a free and independent search for truth and meaning. We believe alike in the inherent worth and dignity of all people. We share much common ground, but the content of our beliefs is in fact very different. She sees things that I do not see, and I'm confident that I see truths that she cannot imagine. And yet I would hate for us to be somehow separated. In a town of 1,000 people, it becomes very clear that when you are as odd as a humanist or as odd as a pagan, there is nowhere else to go. We are kin more than we know. The odd family in the larger community, to be sure, but kin nonetheless. And yet we are distant kin, for we often don't speak. In my travels around my district, I see ample evidence that pagans and humanists rarely, if ever, dialogue with one another. We avoid one another. We don't talk about the uncomfortable differences. We opt for speaking about vague generalities of shared values, but don't argue about the content because it would be too uncomfortable. And yet, if we're truly kin, if we are compelled to accept one another when we come home, then we clearly need to learn to talk not simply in the language of principles and values, but about the content of our beliefs. We need to be patient with one another. We need to ask probing questions of one another. And we need, most importantly, to be willing to disagree profoundly and vigorously while remaining in our mother's house.
Joan? I was really intrigued with the idea of talking in terms of a marriage metaphor. Rather than seeing it as a process of cohabitation or looking upon the relationship between paganism and humanism as that of sibling or cousin, it seemed to me that the relationship was that of an arranged marriage, where the two parties hadn't really spoken to each other before the ceremony. And the UUA was acting as matchmaker. But like a good matchmaker, they looked at the areas of compatibility in background before bringing the two parties together. And I think that UU humanists and UU pagans do have a number of areas of compatibility in their backgrounds. I think that the principles and purposes articulate many of these compatibility areas, and there have been a number of other workshops here at this GA that have enumerated others. This reminds me of a definition of UU paganism that's a little bit popular among CUPS folk, that UU pagans are actually humanists with a slightly exaggerated sense of the aesthetic. Now, like a good and thoughtful arranged marriage, we have a lot in common. And building on those compatibilities, we could develop a truly committed and covenantal relationship. But as in many marriages, there are times of misunderstanding and times of miscommunication when bickering starts to happen. Now, those of you who do marriage counseling, you know that when you hear statements involving the words never and always, that you are dealing with matters of emotion and emotional perception rather than verifiable or empirical fact. You know what I mean. Mm-hmm. He always leaves the toothpaste tube top off. She never closes the front door. He never cleans out the cat box, things like that. We have to look at these always and never statements a little bit more closely. We have to talk about them in counseling and diffuse them and take their emotional impact and deal with it. If we don't do that, there's no real conversation taking place. Conversation can't take place when you're using always and never statements. As president of CUPS, I hear a lot of always and never statements from both pagans and humanists. Let me lay a couple of these out for you. Now remember, these are statements of emotion and perception and not empirical fact. Humanists say about pagans, they are always superstitious. They always have a sloppy theology. They're never rational in their thought. They're very bad public relations for the UUism. They're always embarrassing, dangerous, silly. They always have problems with society because society will always misunderstand them. They're just using our facilities and don't really care about the church. They're always trying to take over and wreck what we've built. Or they're just a fad. Looks like a bunch of old hippies. Or they're amusing at best, but never really serious. And always too secretive, just what are they really doing in the basement with the cat? And then pagans, on the other hand, say about humanists, they're always joyless. They're never in touch with their hearts or emotions. They're always cold and hard. They never have a sense of humor. They always put down anything that isn't analytic science or hard rationalism. They always treat us as if we were stupid. They never listen. They always attack and try to push those out who do not fit their model of what should be in the church. They always try to control all of the resources in the congregation, and they never let us share in the congregational life. Examples, just very brief examples of the lack of reality that surrounds the use of these statements. One woman complained to me once that her church would never allow a CUPS chapter, that her board would never listen to her, and she was just certain of this. They were a bunch of old humanists. It wasn't worth trying, and she was going to give up. And yet her minister and three board members were actually members in good standing of CUPS at the time. She hadn't tried. She had simply assumed and hadn't asked. On the other hand, a gentleman, a self-avowed humanist, complained to me that the CUPS chapter in his church was filled with outsiders who had no interest in the life of the church, and they never participated. It turns out that 10 out of the 12 members of the chapter were pledging members of the church and had been for years. Several had been on multiple committees, including the board, Sunday service, membership, finance, and two were longtime RE instructors. To me, this just shows that always and never statements are not always based on unbiased understanding. There's just too much bickering going on and not enough open conversation, honest conversation. Maybe we need a little marriage counseling. We need to look again at our vows. What do you pagans promise to the humanists? What do the humanists promise to you pagans? What do we promise to each other? And what do we promise to the UUA?
And last, I call Kendall Gibbons.
Can this marriage be saved? I devoutly hope so, because I am a child of it. And if it cannot be saved, I am likely to find myself the object of a most painful and unseemly custody battle. Whether or not they knew it, the Unitarian Universalist parents and Sunday school teachers in the 1950s and 60s who structured my religious education around the principles enunciated by Sophia Foss as interpreted through their own post-war optimistic rationalism were cultivating a generation of little pagans. Gone were the images of Jesus, either on the cross or with a lamb tucked under his arm. Only silly, childish people needed to believe in Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or a fatherly God, according to my parents. Prayer was nothing but self-incantation. We were not watched over by any presence for either judgment or care. There was no appeal but to our own labor, intelligence, and responsibility. It was a daunting world, stripped of ceremony or symbol. Two objects of reverence only were permitted to us. Year after year, we poked bean seeds into wax Dixie cups half filled with potting soil, and were given to understand that something special and inexplicable was happening in that short period between when the sprout lifted its two hopeful seed leaves into the light and when it subsequently perished from either under or over watering. And if any of us was lucky enough to find the carcass of a dead robin in the backyard, we were encouraged to contemplate the mysterious change that differentiated it from its living counterparts. Also, it was assumed that walking in the woods would necessarily induce in us a kind of atavistic, oceanic appreciation of nature with a capital N. It baffles me that anyone could be surprised that such an educational program should produce a generation of Unitarian Universalists who find themselves hungry for the color and drama of ritual and at home with the cross quarters of the year and the pre-Socratic philosophers. What in heaven's name did they expect? The Christmas pageants we performed downplayed the arrival of baby Jesus and lifted up the cross-cultural traditions of Yuletide. I don't think that I was ever merry, but I distinctly remember constituting one of a quartet of sheet-clad druid maidens in a pantomime of gathering mistletoe. When I began, to the consternation I suspect of the good rationalists who raised me, to take seriously the integrity of my own religious questions instead of theirs, I found that the door to a traditional self-conscious male deity was closed to me by the long habit of disdain. But the path from the nature mysticism of the dead bird and walking in the woods to a planetary environmentalism and the Gaia hypothesis, to a projected female deity rediscovered in the pre-Christian pantheons, had not been so preempted. The image of the goddess became a useful landmark in my spiritual reverse pilgrimage as I groped to understand the meaning of the human experience and enterprise of faith. Liberal neo-paganism, as I was taught to understand it, proposed nothing that was not intellectually compatible with the rationalism of my childhood religious instruction. Its appreciation of mythology harked back to Fa's tales from long ago in many lands, interesting stories that invited us to consider the deeper analogical meanings of our experiences as human beings. If the new paganism took the folk dancing that we practiced as children in the dusty church attic, intended to teach us appreciation of other cultures, outdoors under the full moon, it was merely an enriching change of venue. The insistence upon taking responsibility for what one evoked in the world through behavior and thought harked back to the ethical culture hymnal we used in Sunday school. Think truly, and thy honest thought a hungry world shall feed. Speak truly, and each word of thine shall be a fruitful seed. Live truly, and thy life shall be a great and noble creed. Nurtured as I was in this approach, I neither can nor wish to choose between my humanist and pagan parentage. Nor do I despise the Jewish and Christian monotheism that are my beloved grandparents. I understand the tensions, but I maintain that they grow out of a deliberately distorted caricature, and I insist that all of us are better than that. I have no more use for a self-righteously exclusive and sentimentally dogmatic monotheism than I do for a willfully ignorant, superstitious, and silly paganism, or for a rigid, deracinated, joyless, and belligerent humanism. But none of these are the Unitarian Universalist clan whose beloved and loving child I have always been. If this marriage is not saved, it will be the doing of fear, intolerance, and the failure of communication and goodwill, which were, I thought, the very habits of heart and mind against which all my religious teachers sought to warn me. Not only would that be a pity, it would constitute a betrayal of the best genius of each heritage.
Questions for our panel. Lady, that was first.
This is wonderful, and it's also just transformative to me to see so many people in this room committed to this issue. I need to be able to take back to my classmates at seminary and my churches, if possible, sort of a definition or a summary of religious humanism as opposed to humanism, because I've read a lot of definitions of humanism, but religious humanism we're not clear on, and also paganism. I know that those are big hard premises, but that's something that I want from this to take back to New England.
They all stare at one another. associated with the religious humanists, we're going to pick on you.
How about a definition of you, too?
Oh, yeah. Piece of cake.
The question was to present a definition of religious humanism and a definition of paganism, for which someone said, and we can throw in a definition of UU while we're at it. So to bring this back to seminary.
They had months, even years, to cobble together the Nicene Creed.
Yeah.
My experience of the humanist movement and the often the hair-splitting distinctions between religious humanism and secular humanism and humanism humanism and God knows what else, pardon me, is that it often involves the narcissism of small differences.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, that's something that not just in the humanist movement, but in Unitarian Universalism, we have elevated to an art form. Simply stated, I would be inclined to go with a definition offered by Henry Simmons, which makes humanism sound rather earth-centered.
Mm-hmm.
But Henry Simmons simply argued that a humanistic approach to religion was that approach that concerned itself with earthly concerns and earthly cares and focused on the health and well-being of human individuals spiritually, physically, socially.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Do we have a brave pagan to take on the definition of paganism?
Do you want to answer that, please?
Well, I was perhaps, yeah, let me take another stab at the humanism. Is it not picking me up? Yes, okay. Here, okay. My sense is that humanism, as we define it in my congregation at the moment, says that to be a humanist is to affirm the sufficiency of human experience and a commitment to learning to live with greater human dignity in this world in pursuit of meaning and joy. And I think the distinction between secular humanism and religious humanism really has to do with how people appreciate or fail to appreciate the heritage of religious imagery and practice. And I don't think that's a question of morality. It's not like you have to any more than people have to like symphonic music or any other art form. But for many of us, that heritage constitutes a resource in that learning to live with dignity process and that pursuit of meaning and joy. So that's where I would begin to draw that distinction, although I agree with Stefan, it's kind of hair splitting.
I think that paganism is in the process of formation, so you're not going to find a definition that all pagans would ever agree to. You get six pagans in a room and you'll have eight definitions. But there are some elements that I would say are generic or fairly common. A couple of those. One would be an immanent theology, or the idea of the divine or the holy or the universe or life force or whatever you want to call it, as being pervasive, as immanent, whether you call that monism or pantheism or panentheism. Another is an emphasis on the wholeness of the human being. There's the head and the heart. There's the intellect and experience that needs to be brought to our religious being. And one should not be emphasized over the other, but both have to be honored. And then a couple of other things that I will read from the old humanist manifesto, which are also elements that I find true in paganism. One, it says that holding an organic view of life, humanists, and I'd say pagans too, find that the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected. Big time. It says that humanism, and I'd say also pagans, believe that humans are a part of nature and that they have emerged as a result of continuous process. Also, from this older manifesto, religion consists of those actions, purposes, and experiences which are humanly significant. Nothing human is alien to the religious. It includes labor, art, science, philosophy, love, friendship, recreation, all that is in its degree expressive of intelligently satisfying human living. And the distinction between the sacred and the secular can no longer be maintained. And here I would also find a truism of paganism.
I'd like to follow on with Joan by actually, Corin, are you in the room?
Yeah, he's
Corin, I'm going to quote you from your Berry Street lecture from last year. I'm just warning you. Emerson somehow understood that how we treat and involve ourselves with nature and the way we treat and involve ourselves with other human beings are profoundly related. The implication being that nature and people and individuals of all colors and circumstances are morally equal to one another, and that together we bear responsibility for social justice and what today we call ecological responsibility for the earth. In such an interpretive framework, nature becomes a great equalizer.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the important things that I try and communicate with folks about... We're having trouble with the microphone, I think.
There you go.
One of the problems I think that folks have when they talk about paganism and other quote-unquote earth-centered religions is that really it's a misnomer. It's not earth-centered. Mm. It is community-centered. What it is an understanding based actually in a continuation of the liberal enlightenment project of expanding the understanding of who is a member of the community. What contemporary paganism and others have done, and also is true in a lot of indigenous traditions, where we find people talking, traditions talking about, you know, Mother Earth and Father Sky, etc., and our brothers, the winged and the legged, the finned, is that it is an expansive, radical understanding of what community involves, or who is part of community, and therefore, who are we in direct and consequential relationship with. And I think that one of the things that contemporary paganism tries to do is to make this explicit.
Mm-hmm.
While it has been implicit in much of humanism for a great long while, and other traditions as well, that I think is one of the distinguishing hallmarks. I see David Bombaugh over here nodding his head, and he wrote a very important article from a speech a few years ago called The Heart of a Faith for the 21st Century, in which he lifts up the seventh principle of Unitarian Universalism as one of our radical, as probably our radical gospel, as the faith statement that we have in common, which is most uniquely ours and probably has the greatest implication for our lives on this planet and a redeeming message for the rest of the world. So it's a matter of who we are, what is community? And I would say pagans say we're all in community,
mm-hmm.
and therefore we're all responsible to and for each other.
Thank you. Before we go to the next question, I would like to say that it looks like a lot of folks do have something they'd like to ask, so if you can keep your questions brief, we can get more people. And you've been waiting?
I actually gave a Tulsa talk the other day and read the title for this thing in the free program and addressed it very briefly. I said I certainly feel a tension between these two beliefs, but it's the sort that leads to growth, not divorce. And to respond more particularly to the notion of the children in the family arguing about the inheritance, I think UUism has a unique ability to use these different elements to grow the inheritance and to end up in such a huge win-win situation and learning from each other that we're in, you know, perfect division.
Mm. Thank you. Other questions? Over again, so, oh, okay. Here. We'll get to you next. Can't hear you.
You're talking about all the comments.
Please stand.
We can repeat it.
Yeah, we'll repeat it.
I'll repeat it if I can get the gist of it.
Thank you.
You're talking about all the commonalities. Would you tell us a little bit what the difference is on?
Question. The question is, what are the perceived differences in the two paths?
Perceived or real?
Feel free to argue among yourself.
I get to work with Unitarian Universalist congregations in conflict, which doesn't give me a unique perspective, but perhaps a rare perspective on differences. They are there, and as I perceive the arguments playing themselves out in our congregations between positions variously described as humanism and spirituality, or humanism and paganism, depending on the particular congregation you're working with, or in some cases, you know, even Christianity and humanism. What I see is significant differences in content and behavior. That, if you will, the principles and values are the skeleton that we may hang our faith on, but we enflesh it with different content. So that, you know, most humanists, I would suggest, are uncomfortable if the love and appreciation of nature becomes personified in some manner. That the humanist is generally quite comfortable with abstract notions of nature. That how we do rituals vary. And of course, humanists have rituals as much as both they and others deny it. We have rituals that are meaningful to us, but they do tend to differ from the rituals of those who are involved in groups like CUPS. And this creates, it seems to me, the discomfort. Mm-hmm. We can generally agree on principle, but we argue with one another when we start bowing in the four directions, or when we refuse to bow in the four directions. That both things cause conflict in our congregations. And it seems to be more about behaviors around the dinner table than it is about larger issues.
I also do quite a bit of work with congregations that are having some difficulty understanding one another, usually the pagans not understanding the Christians or the humanists or others, and vice versa. The issues have always been revolving around the use of symbols and religious language, just like Stefan says, as opposed to the more substantial theological issues. The way we, the significance that we give various symbols do differ. There's a difference between an abstract approach and a concrete approach. The pagans tend to be more intentional in their development of ritual, whereas other UUs have had rituals that have simply grown up a little bit more organically. And there's usually some argument about whether an intentional ritual is more or less authentic than one that has grown up over several generations organically. When people can come to see that all forms of ritual and use of different symbol systems are still based in human religious need and in the human religious personality, I think they get a better understanding of one another and see that whether it's a new ritual or an old one, that it's still meaningful to the human soul.
Very patient woman in the back.
No, I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're still.
No.
You've got to give me a single. No,
we're still.
Go ahead.
We're good.
Oh, okay.
I would agree with the last speaker to a certain extent that it is behavior that we face in our church. We are, if the survey is correct, more humanistically inclined by numbers, and our church is joyful, spontaneous, experimental, and wild. A small church, and but we had a trust or a group come in, and their behavior was such that we had problems. They would not ask permission or notify us when the building was used, fundraising projects were carried out, but we had no knowledge of our church name. We were advertised on the internet to the extent of this is where you come when you want to come to somebody here to say, speakers were so interactive and alive without their knowledge or ours, and it was this kind of behavior, and we were told they were poor people and could not commit any money or funds, and that when asked, we were told we would have to work harder and pay more money in order to support their group, which they were entitled to be, but to be the way after. And it was this kind of behavior. And as we got together in study groups, joined over 33 months and contacted other churches to find out, hoping to find successful experiences, material kept rolling into us about other churches having similar kinds of problems. So I'm hoping to find some kind of light on that particular kind of problem. Were we unusual? I don't know that they were from where we gathered our information. But I am concerned about it for institutional reasons.
I'd like to talk to this. I'm a congregational minister. I serve Unitarian Universalist congregations. That's my charge in with the congregation. And I've had colleagues come to me about dysfunctional groups in their midst, and that's really what you're talking about, is a dysfunctional group, and I don't care what their theology is. And I hate to tell you this, but these dysfunctional groups cross the spectrum theologically. As I have told colleagues before, do not put up with such nonsense. When a CUPS chapter was formed in my current congregation, I took them aside and said, look, you know, CUPS stands for Covenant of Unitarian Universalist Pagans, not Collection of Undifferentiated, Undefined Pyromaniacs. The emphasis is on the fact that the UU goes before the word pagan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that dysfunctionality can work both ways. There have been humanist groups that were equally demanding and uncooperative in their congregational context, and I would agree with Patrick. There's no reason to put up with that, regardless of the theology being advocated.
Mm-hmm. There's a question. Oh, did you want to say?
Since I first raised the behavior issue, I need to be clear that based on a premise I learned in theological school, that original sin is equitably distributed. When I was referring to behavior, in large measure, I was imagining things like taste in worship, that humanists and pagans worship differently. I recall some years ago, Judith Haler, a UU Christian minister, suggesting that the then three predominant theological positions in the movement, Christianity, theism, and humanism, were probably mutually exclusive when it came to worship. I also remember spending about the next 12 years trying to argue that point and finally arriving at Judith's conclusion that the extent to which a pagan is comfortable in a humanist congregation has to do with their ability to function within the worship life of that congregation, which will be dominated by a particular flavor. and require a certain amount of translation in order to be present. And the same would be true in terms of a humanist belonging to King's Chapel mm-hmm. or belonging to a predominantly pagan congregation, that it requires a certain willingness to be able to translate what happens in the central worship experience, which will tend to fall into one of the broad theological categories we have. And it requires a tremendous amount of patience, but I think also requires us to recognize that these flavors, if you will, or tendencies will develop by default, by a slowly emerging consensus within a congregation.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen,
I'd just like to add very, very quickly that rude is rude, and we don't have to deal with rude people. We can ask them to leave. Mm-hmm. But one thing that CUPS does try to emphasize to those UU pagans who contact us and say, we want to be a CUPS chapter, or how do we form a chapter? We emphasize that they need to be an active, participatory, integral element of their home congregation. They need to have the approval of their church board to be recognized as an official CUPS group. In other words, yes, CUPS is the covenant of Unitarian Universalist highlighted pagans. And that's very much a part of who we are.
Okay, there's a gentleman here in the yellow shirt.
What was just described back here sounded very familiar to me. I think I know there are situations that happen like that, and that really is a dysfunctional group and so on. But also, I was reminded of what someone said at the beginning about it, people were saying that word always. In our situation, I think there was a lot of misunderstanding and failure of communication where people in our church saying that there's a drumming for the network. Organized like we were. There were people who were saying many of these same things I mentioned, which were very inaccurate, that the people had no interest in the church. They were just there, sort of ripping off facilities and wouldn't contribute even to the lights and so on and so forth. And a lot of it was lack of communication. No one had asked anyone mm-hmm. to take up a question. As soon as the group was asked, they started putting a basket on it. Could you contribute mm-hmm. something for cleaning the church and the lights and so on? Mm-hmm. We started reading the principles of lighting the chalice before we began the drumming mm-hmm. and said that anyone wanted to know more about our church. But there were a lot of people in the community who were coming. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it was outreach to the church, if you look at it that way, looking at it as a bunch of outsiders coming to use our church.
Mm-hmm.
Problems of perception, problems of preconceived ideas, and if people talk to each other, they find out the situation isn't quite what they thought.
There have been misbehaviors on both sides of the aisle. We have many stories over the last 10 years, and fortunately, these things have decreased mm-hmm. over time mm-hmm. radically, mm-hmm. and we've been very intentional about this. But there are many stories of humanistically based congregations driving CUPS groups out of their congregations where there are members of their own board in the CUPS group and driving out 20 or 30 people who are integrated, invested members of the congregation because they feel that there is an investment here that they have to protect in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Something I want to take just a quick comment on is I think one of the differences that was asked about is that there is a paradigm that we're dealing with here that is in transition, and it's in transition in the larger culture. And it's a paradigm shift from either or to both and.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the critiques that we had in seminary of both humanism and theism as we've inherited it up to this point, Christianity particularly, is that they operate out of an either-or paradigm, a dualistic paradigm. As much as I reject dualism theologically, it still operates that way mm-hmm. sociologically.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're finding is that groups like the pagans and the Buddhists and the women's groups and the environmental groups come in with a both-and or cooperative approach, and the two groups don't know how to get along together because they aren't playing by the same rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there's a lot of conflict and misunderstanding. What we're finding is that a lot of the humanist members, particularly who are older, are used to a paradigm where if they're not in charge, then they're going to be subjugated. They're going to be controlled. They're going to be run out of their own church. And they're really afraid of that. There's a tremendous amount of fear there. And it's real. And it has to be addressed. And the pagans, on the other hand, a lot of them come from situations where they have been abused, and you know, some people have lost their jobs. People lose their children over this. This is a real issue for them in the real world. And they come to a place where they think they can be cooperative, and they want to get along and create a wonderful, diverse community, and but they don't know how to talk to people who aren't talking the same language they are. So part of it is we're talking very different paradigmatic languages. And this is also a transition that's happening in the larger community, in the larger culture, and therefore we need to know how to do that for ourselves so we can take it out into the larger community.
Are you... Okay. We've got a lot of people looking to ask questions, and we don't have a lot of time left, so I please ask you to be as brief as possible. Did Krista, and then the gentleman in the suit.
I would just like to respond to the concerns you have, and the other people you spoke to. It's very important to cut organizationally. That people go to CUPS and tell them about the project. If a group is not really a CUPS group, and many, many groups are out there that are causing some cancer, even those that are directed, if the group is not really a CUPS group, you can still bring some pressure to bear. If they are a CUPS group, someone will be able to mediate some of these problems.
And they're in the suit. Yes, you. You're looking around. That's you. All right.
I'm trying to get my words together. This has been a really very enlightening and intelligent discussion, and I think the panel deserves credit for setting the mood for this. I'm wondering whether or not the metaphor of marriage is necessary. How about the metaphor of friendship? I would prefer that myself. I don't think that we have to engage in the Ground that might exist, in fact, that probably should exist, so that everybody is not so damned afraid of every new movement that comes along, would be a far greater and deeper knowledge and understanding of inherent universalist and, more broadly speaking, liberal religious history, so that we don't come in, so that people don't come in through these little doors, you know, a little paganism here, a little humanism there, a little theism there. We really do neglect our history. We are ahistoric, and since we don't have a fixed consensual statement, and I agree that these various principles that we have enunciated represent the distillation of our history, that still does not give an existential sense of what the history is to do know. So I think the clergy really have a major responsibility to know that history and to share it on a regular month-to-month basis. And I think that tends to dissipate a good deal of the nervousness or the whining or the tension of being subjugated or marginalized, and simply allow us to attribute to one another a certain moral equality of acceptance and then go from there. That's why I would prefer the metaphor of friendship rather than that matter.
Just thank you. Just a very, very brief response. I do agree with you about the history. It's extremely important. That's why one of the adult curriculum we just put together, an outline, does include a major element about UU history, particularly the Transcendentalists. And we do teach our class on Introduction to UU Paganism with a section, a large section on Transcendentalist background, which I think is very compatible with modern paganism.
The history question, it seems to me, is significant. And it is related to this being, I think, an adopted faith for most of our members. 5 out of 6 Unitarian Universalists come from somewhere else. And I mean, we can have, if you will, a family where we sit around a common table and share our stories, or we can have a kind of a spiritual soup kitchen in which people come to get what they personally need but don't really share in the common story. And if we're going to develop that sense of common ground, it will be by sharing those stories from our history that help to explain how humanists and pagans ended up in this association together.
Well, and I want to point out that there's one out of six of us who did grow up in this tradition. And I think part of the challenge for those folks who are coming in and making those discoveries is not to ask us to choose up sides, because we don't need to do that.
Thank you. There's a lot of questions. I'm going to do my best to get the people who are really needing to ask. There's a woman in a white shirt there who's been waiting for a while.
This is a question for Stephanie and Kendall. I heard what I referred to as institutional paganism owning an interest in dealing with this traditional paganism. I'd be interested in hearing institutional humanism owning who's to be dealing with the problem humanism.
The question is that we've heard dialogue about how institutionalized paganism within the UA is trying to deal with the smooth integration of pagan groups into a congregation. And the question is there an institutional response to humanist groups that are similarly, that may have similar problems?
It's my experience in working with our congregations that most of our members imagine that in terms of Fowler's stages of faith, they have somehow arrived at stage five. It's my personal experience that, in fact, ours is something of an adolescent faith, that in terms of our interactions with one another, in terms of our theological sophistication, we are a gathering of adolescents and behave like adolescents. I think more often than not, the sad truth of the matter is that our congregations are brutal in terms of interactions between people. And that tends to cross theologies. It crosses age groups. It crosses social class. It may be something that we have in common.
Okay. So we've got limited time and a lot of questions, so I am going to be a little arbitrary here and say one, two, gentlemen in the black coat, gentlemen in the very back, gentlemen in the white shirt, and gentlemen in the striped shirt, if you can remember your places. I'll be awfully grateful. Let's go through those folks, and if we have time, we'll add more to the queue.
Okay, thank you. I came to my paganism through my bachelor's in physics, and so I've been studying the physical universe, and I really don't see that there's a problem here. However, I do recognize that there is one in my congregation. And 10 years ago, 8 years ago, it was really nasty, and now it has gotten better and better, and I see that more communication going on. I'd like to hear the panelists say something about the future and about what we can do in our congregation to help the dialogue, to help the understanding grow.
The question is, what can we do for the future to help the dialogue and to help the family grow? Mm-hmm.
I think that holding conversations like this within your congregation can really help. Actually, the idea for this whole panel came from First Unitarian in Denver, where we held a two-person panel, myself and one other, and called it Paganism, Humanism, Can This Marriage Be Saved? And spent the morning in adult forum discussing these issues.
To me, that one of the important things in terms of what do we need to do in order to keep this relationship vital and keep the rapprochement going on is for each group to try to become aware of what it is that the other group is afraid of. I mean, I really think I know a lot of humanists who had to fight really hard in their personal lives and in their institutional lives to make space for their position. And what they are resisting is not so much someone else going through the same thing they did, but that being taken away from them. Mm-hmm. Same thing with the pagans. When people have gone through the kinds of things Patrick was talking about, they're understandably nervous. And if we could really have a sense of what that fear is for each other, I think we'd deal a lot more understandingly and compassionately and ultimately effectively with each other.
I think in facilitating the conversation, to look at, using wedding vows or covenantal statements, whatever it is that is our agreement to be together, which for us in many ways is our principles and purposes, our congregational faith statements and mission statements, which almost all have something resonant about how we're going to be with each other, and keep that first and foremost in our mind and realize we're in a conversation, not an argument.
Okay, such a moment here. Oh, I'm sorry.
I would generally agree with the sentiment. I think, though, that if we're going to have an honest conversation and if we're really going to have a marriage of the minds and hearts, we also have to deal with some fundamental truth questions where we disagree mm-hmm. fundamentally. Mm-hmm. And so that we have had, a comfortable and friendly conversation here. Mm-hmm. And I think should come away from here feeling as though we can discuss things with one another on friendly terms. Mm-hmm. By the same token, we need to be prepared to stay in the conversation mm-hmm. at those points in time where we start to challenge one another's right. truth claims.
Right. Absolutely.
And if we don't get to that level of dialogue, mm-hmm. then it's rather artificial.
Right. But that level is based on a kind of trust that only comes about from being able to have this kind of civil conversation.
I think it's important to point out that tolerance is necessary but not sufficient
mm-hmm.
to this kind of thing. I do a lot of interfaith work, and in using Diana Eck's work from her book Encountering God and her concept of religious pluralism, that the purpose for this kind of conversation, again, is not for conversion
right.
or agreement. It is for purpose of being rooted in your place. And I think it's real important, if you call yourself a humanist, you've got to understand what it really means to be a humanist. Because as a pagan, we require that also. And then if you really understand that, then you can be open to engaging the other in a way that will be transformative for you and transformative for them. And you have to be willing to be open to the risk of transformation and change. But what comes out of that then is an opportunity for you to actually deepen in your own faith, your own tradition, in your own path. And that's the purpose behind interfaith dialogue, which is really what we're talking about, is a form of interfaith dialogue within the covenant of Unitarian Universalist Congregation.
And this is just establishing the kind of groundwork where we can come together and really begin those close, honest conversations.
Thank you.